The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back to everyone. Well, like most people, I'm fixated to my phone. My screen time goes up, and maybe that's because I'm looking at these commodity prices. WTI oil is at $82 a barrel.
Wow.
I mean, who would have said it's doubled in over a year? And the effects of this have not yet rippled through, I think, to the broader economy, to the gas pump, and so on. We've talked about this before in previous podcasts, but there's a number of elements to this, right?
Mm-hmm. And we've got the high gas prices as well. In fact, I went and looked, we're at about $3.25 on average for gasoline prices in the U.S., which is getting close to that point where we start to maybe worry about demand. We're maybe not quite there, but anything above this, I think, it's going to start to be a concern.
And here in Canada, the price of gasoline for regular has gone over $1.50 a liter. There's a bit of psychology to that. I know it's much higher in some other provinces as well.
When you layer on all the taxes.
When you layer it on. But I mean, that's probably reflective of last month's oil prices because it takes time to percolate through the system. So it's going higher.
Before we start with the podcast for this week, I do want to thank Wayne from Toronto. We love feedback from our listeners around our electric car episode from last week. And he wanted to correct me that there are a few highways in the Toronto area and into Quebec that have pretty good electrical coverage for fast charging. Highway 401, we've all heard about that, and many of us have driven on it. It has good coverage, and it is quite a bit further south than the Trans-Canada.
Sure.
And also Highway 40 in Quebec, which is on the other side of the St. Lawrence Seaway from Highway 1. So I was corrected, and I really do appreciate when people give us feedback.
Yeah.
But there are some areas, especially in our really populated areas, where there's a bit better ability. He talked about the fact that in the greater Toronto area and even getting into some of the Lake Country, there is some ability to get around.
Yeah. Okay. We stand corrected.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
Great. So there is a geopolitical element to these higher oil prices. We've talked about that before. And it's great to talk about that today. So we have a very special guest. All our guests are very special. On the line from Washington, D.C., Matthew J. Sagers, Vice President at IHS Market and Head of the Russian and Caspian Energy Advisory Service. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here and talk to some of my friends in Western Canada. But I guess, given the fact that you already talked about one of your listeners in Toronto, it probably means that it's Canada-wide then in that case.
Yeah, we have listeners from around Canada and even some in the U.S. We even get a few from Texas. So now, for the benefit of our audience and by way of introduction, tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to follow Russia and Caspian energy issues.
Well, that's a long story. I've been doing this for about 40 years now. And I got hooked on this as a young guy when I took a Russian history class. So I just go, man, these guys are really strange. I got to find out more about that. And then I was a geographer by training, and it turns out that when you study the geography of Russia or the USSR, resources are very heavy, and of course, the king of all resources are the energy side. So it's this loud siren song that keeps singing in my ear and just drove me on and on and on. So like I said, I've been doing this for a long time, and it was just sort of accidental, I guess, would be the way to call it. It wasn't something that I set out to do originally.
And you learned Russian along the way, I understand.
Yeah, I took Russian in college and then spent an intensive summer as a young guy in what's called the Institute of Russian Language for foreign students in Moscow. And the group that was there before us were Cubans because they had laid out a baseball field out in the thing. And I was wondering, who on earth plays baseball here in this place? And then when I asked about it, they said, yeah, the group before you were a bunch of Cubans.
You came to IHS Market, and I worked with you there, and I really enjoyed hearing from you about Russia and Caspian energy, so I'm really excited for our conversation today.
Yeah, we've already alluded to the resources of Russia, and you know, in some ways it's similar to Canada. Russia's the largest country in the world, Canada the second largest by area, both countries extremely resource-rich. But when it comes to, and we're talking about Russia now, when it comes to IMF data, the size of its economy is actually less than Italy. It's 10% of the United States. Other than the fact that they're a major nuclear power, can you give us a sense of why they're so important geopolitically?
Well, that was actually what I was going to say. Essentially, Russia is an energy superpower. When you look at it, number one, number two, number three, number four, on virtually any of the energy supply questions, gas, oil, coal, nuclear, electric power, they're in that range, and it's fluctuated back and forth depending upon whether the number one, number two, number three, or number four over the years. So it's basically an energy superpower coupled with the fact that they have nuclear weapons.
How reliant are they on oil and gas, or are they more balanced in terms of their natural resources revenue?
They're more balanced than, let's say, for example, the Middle East in terms of what their economy is. It's a more diverse economy than some of the oil producers in the Middle East. But nonetheless, oil and gas is still really, really important. If we just look at the first half of this year in 2021, it accounts for 53.5% of export earnings. And that's been approximately the percentage now for quite some time. Whether you look at budget revenues or whether you look at export earnings, it's in that same range. It goes up and down depending upon what prices are. But this is one of the things that makes them a lot different than their peers in the Middle East. They have a much lower, you know, what's called a break-even point in terms of oil prices because they're a consumer as well as being a producer. And so they tend to be a little bit less hawkish about working with the Middle East and so forth and OPEC than the past. But the situation back in 2015, 2016, it sort of sharpened the mind a little bit and created a much more amenable track for them to collaborate. And they have quite successfully in a series of agreements since then.
Yeah, and for those in our audience that don't know, Russia is the largest producer of oil in the world. I think they're up to now 12 million barrels a day or something like that. Is that?
Goes back and forth. Right now, it's actually Saudi. You know, this month, next month, it's that kind of thing.
They're neck and neck with the Saudis in terms of size. Let's talk about control, because these companies in Russia are big. They're dominantly state-controlled. And I guess from a Western lens, Western media lens, it sounds like Vladimir Putin has his hands in all of these sort of state-controlled companies. Is that true?
I mean, yes and no. Oil and gas that basically trip the economy, that generate the budget revenues and make Russia, Russia, after all. And of course, one of the other things that Putin did very early on, you know, 2004, was to basically reclaim a lot of this back from the private sector through a variety of means. And so the result is you have Gazprom that's basically state-owned, Rosneft on the oil side and whatnot, but you still have a lot of the sector that is still privatized. I mean, Lukoil is still a private company. And so the control over the sector is still what I would call sort of indirect. It's through the means of regulatory authority and tax authority and so forth.
But I guess, you know, where we're getting to, and we're going to talk about Russia and Europe and natural gas and potentially control of oil because they're now part of the OPEC Plus group. I guess, yes, a company like Lukoil is private and you have all these other ones, Gazprom, Rosneft, etc. When he speaks, they listen, right? If there's a geopolitical motivation, they listen.
Yes, and usually he has some kind of idea about what they should be doing. So, for example, if he says something like, gasoline prices are getting a little uncomfortable in Russia, they listen about what that is, and they think about what they can do. But usually there's a follow-up that goes along with that that filters its way through the ministries and operations and so forth, where they're thinking about some kind of tax operation or other kinds of administrative means to basically change the pricing mechanisms and so forth. They have excise taxes, they have export taxes. They also have a very complex mechanism. They're now watching what prices are internationally and kind of how they relate domestically and whether the refineries and operations have to pay into the system or take out of the system. So it's just much more administered would be the way that I would characterize it. And of course, at the top of that administrative pyramid is none other than Vladimir Vladimirovich.
Let's talk a little bit about the natural gas history. In 2006, it's well known that most of Russia's gas exports were transited through the Ukraine. But in 2006 and 2009, Russia reduced their flows to exert political pressure on the country, which also, you know, hurt Europe.
Gee, I wonder if it might have had anything to do with the fact that Ukraine didn't pay the gas bill, Jackie.
Well, you know, that was one of the claims, but it hurt Europe too.
Basically, it was a story of where in the past they had this situation that when Ukraine was pressed to pay, Ukraine would basically borrow the gas from the flow going across it. It basically greatly undermined any kind of pressure that they brought to bear on them to pay the bill. In those two times, lasted a very short time, they basically decide, well, okay, we're going to basically do that. The first time they didn't cut off the flow to Europe. Second time they did for a period of, you know, I forget how many days it was, 10 days or something like that. Again, guess who gets the fault for that?
So, Matt, am I interpreting it correctly that you're saying that this was an accounts payable issue and not a geopolitical issue?
It became a geopolitical issue.
Yeah, because Europe looked at it as, we can't really rely on that source of supply. And a lot of things happened, right? There were new pipelines built to diversify supply away from that one transit route.
Yes, and remember, at the same time, we had another process going on where Russia had already decided that Ukraine was not exactly a great partner on this. And so right from the very beginning of independence of the different countries, they had decided that they would work on a series of bypass pipelines. And so over the years, they had completed a series of these. And the percentage going through Ukraine kept on reducing and reducing and reducing and reducing. So by the time you hit to 2021, they moved only about 55 BCM through Ukraine, and that accounted for 31.5% of the total. This year, the contract through Ukraine is for 40 BCM, and 40 will be somewhere around 20-some-odd percent, 22, something like that, of what Russia's going to deliver this year to Ukraine. So it's been a process, and the route has gone in, as you might guess, a variety of different routes. One route goes through Poland and Belarus. Nord Stream 1 goes underneath the North Sea. Blue Stream goes underneath the Black Sea and goes to Turkey. And then there's been a couple more that have been completed since. So it's been an ongoing process over the past 30 years.
Okay, well, we hear a lot about Nord Stream, especially 2.
Nord Stream 1 was completed a number of years ago, and there really wasn't any controversy. It was basically approved, constructed, done, came into operation and so forth over time. But what has changed with Nord Stream 2 was a couple of things. One was the situation with the Crimea and Ukraine. This became an armed conflict. And so on top of the whole, let's call it geopolitical malaise of what Russia was becoming, was it becoming more authoritarian? It was certainly becoming a whole lot less friendly. It was no longer viewed as being, you know, a particularly good partner for Europe at the same time. So you had a kind of a whole series of things that basically dramatically changed the calculus as to Nord Stream 2. So on top of that, you have the situation where transit through Ukraine is now under threat if Nord Stream 2 is completed. And that means, you know, on the order of about $3 billion of transit revenue that would basically move. And so for Ukraine, this is a kind of an existential moment. And therefore, the pressure is on to basically stop the pipeline altogether. Those sanctions have really not been particularly successful. The pipeline is now completed. It's completed a year and a half later than, you know, was originally scheduled. And there's still kind of the whole issue of startup and everything. But nonetheless, it has been completed and is threatening that kind of revenue position.
But it does go geographically from Russia to Germany.
Yes, right. Directly, without any transit countries in between, exactly.
Right. So just to be clear, so there was the Crimean War crisis, and...
Yeah, although Crimea ended up being almost bloodless, but it was very humiliating. It was the uprising in eastern Ukraine that became bloody and nasty.
So the sanctions that were imposed, were they more about protecting Ukraine's financial interest in the pipeline, or was it as retaliation from the Crimean takeover?
All the above. And one more element is wound into this,
yeah,
because it was basically, if we can stop Russian gas from coming into Europe, we can have the market for ourselves for Texas-based LNG.
Yes, that's what I was going to get at.
It's a combination of three. And then a lot of times when I talk to people, I basically say, you know, why is it that you're so opposed to Nord Stream 2? And the answer is very simple, because Putin wants it. So therefore, we don't. But a lot of the claims that you hear in Washington about what the pipeline is going to do and how it's going to operate, that's all really overblown. What it does is it's not really going to increase the overall volumes. That's really up to kind of what happens in terms of European demand and kind of alternate supplies in terms of what shows up. But what it is going to do is it's going to redirect how that gas arrives in Europe. Mm-hmm. Instead of coming through Ukraine, it's going to be coming directly into Germany and arriving. Mm-hmm. And for the Russians, besides eliminating this chronic irritant that they've had in Ukraine, what it also does, it gives them a new route that is much shorter than before, because their production is shifting northern and westward onto the Yamal Peninsula. So the result is the route is about 1,000 kilometers shorter. Wow. And so if you're concerned about such things as greenhouse gas emissions or methane leaks or all that kind of stuff, it takes a whole lot less gas to run the compressor system. It's much newer, so it doesn't have the same kind of leaks and everything. So Nord Stream 2 is a much greener option, if you want to call it that, than going through Ukraine. So you've also heard all of that nonsense as well, that it's bad for the environment and all this kind of stuff. It does, and its main purpose is to basically reduce Ukraine's leverage in this whole thing.
Okay, so let's move on to today, because this is really relevant, the Nord Stream 2. As you know, and we had a podcast on it a couple of weeks ago, Europe is suffering from the natural gas shortage that's driving the prices very high, currently over $25 US per MMBTU in the UK. Now, typically, when there were such high prices and a shortage, Russia gas would come to the rescue. However, this last summer, Russia's supply did not arrive. Now, recently, Russia's deputy prime minister, Alexander Novak, said that if the Nord Stream 2 came on, that would help ease the situation. My question to you is, why didn't supply grow this past summer? There was plenty of pipeline capacity. And would the situation change with Nord Stream 2?
I don't think the overall situation would change with Nord Stream 2, but it would change the political context, this whole thing. As we look at the situation in the summer, Russia always has lots and lots of spare capacity in the summer. It's the wintertime when capacity is fairly short because they swing up and down. And in terms of our forecasts, we were expecting Russia to have a big bounce this year. We were expecting that after the lows of 2020, that they would produce on the order of, let's say, 30 to 35 BCM more in 2021 than they did in 2022. And basically, the signal coming from Europe is we're recovering fairly slowly as well. We're only going to need about the same amount of gas as what we got last year. So let's say 180 BCM in that range. That's what we're going to be expecting. So as Russia came out of the winter, they had drawn a lot out of storage. So they basically were producing a lot of gas that went into storage, and they basically announced this back in May. They needed to fill storage, and so they basically said, so, you know, during the summer, all you're going to get, or the expectation is all you're going to get is kind of the normal amount of what you've given the signals you want before. Now, again, we can talk about what drove all this stuff, but basically the demand picture in Europe was a lot stronger than what people were thinking as they came out of the pandemic. And overall supply has been lagging in terms of the picture, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about electric power or anything like this. At the same time, that's what's happened in the East as well, in China and so forth. So there's been this large sucking sound of LNG basically heading east. And Europe, essentially, if it wants that LNG to come to Europe, it's going to have to pay the Eastern premium for that, right? And so the main, let's say, departure from Europe has been on the LNG side. Russian gas going into Europe has been about the same as it was last year. What Russia hasn't done is Russia hasn't stepped up to deliver anything more, even as we began reaching late in the summer and the Europeans began screaming and yelling. And when Russia didn't step up, then came the political recriminations. But of course, I want to flip the script. Let's look back at 2021. You had this huge oversupply. A lot of the gas was trying to make its presence into Europe, including this distressed LNG, and prices dropped to incredibly low levels. It was Russia that basically balanced the market, so to speak, because it basically decided, hey, we're not going to move any more gas in there. We don't need to drive this price any lower. So basically, the flexibility that Europe needed basically came from Russia in terms of that. And then this year, Europe is basically saying, yeah, but we need more flexibility from you. And it's like, you just saw it last year. You know, what is it that you want? So it's been a situation where the amount of gas that they can produce has been basically stressed by this combination of rising demand inside their own country, plus this need to refill storage. And then there's also been one other element that people have missed, and this is the story of Turkey. In 2020, Turkey's offtake of European gas just went down through the floor. And the reason, again, was you had this distressed LNG. Turkey basically said, we don't want your oil-linked gas. We're going to buy spot LNG because it's so much cheaper. This year, of course, it's been the reverse. The oil-linked has been much lower than the spot prices. So Turkey has been buying like mad. And under their old contracts and everything, Russia has that kind of flexibility. So Russia has made a big point about the fact that throughout this whole mess, they've been delivering whatever has been contracted. They've met all of their obligations, and that includes Turkey. So Turkish deliveries are up by over 100% this year. So it's a situation where they're complaining about the fact that, gee, all we got was the regular amount of gas, and we'd like some more, please.
So, Matt, you're defending the fact that they're giving a lot of gas and they're being flexible. But there were comments also made by Russia's deputy prime minister about the advantage of long-term contracts. If Europe would sign up to those, then maybe Russia could supply more. So to me, this is geopolitical, and they are using this situation at least to try to secure more long-term contracts and get Nord Stream 2 online.
On the long-term contracts, that's absolutely true. Like I said, Brussels has frowned on them. They wanted basically a very commoditized, day-ahead kind of system where you had marginal prices. And they've been de-emphasizing contracts. The legacy stuff has been allowed to stay in terms of the flexibility and everything. But Russia quite naturally would like to have some long-term contracts because it gives them the confidence to go ahead and invest. Because right now the way that it works is Russia's expected to invest and provide flexibility and an aggregate amount, but without any guaranteed offtakes. And remember that the overall noise coming from Europe all this time has been, we don't want your gas. We don't need your gas. We're moving on to renewables and so forth.
When you say investment, does that investment go all the way back to drilling new wells?
Yeah.
So natural declines kind of kicked in to serve their own markets.
Yeah, there's natural declines kicked in. And with the downturn in 2020 and the cash flow that came with it, quite naturally, Gazprom delayed a number of their upstream projects. But remember that Gazprom is sitting on a huge amount of upstream.
Sure.
They do have a significant amount of spare capacity. And so longer term, clearly Russia is going to invest. But you know, if you had long-term contracts, you'd have a clear idea and maybe could invest a little bit more.
Do you think we're coming into COP26? I think we're probably going to hear more noise about we got to get off this and also the high price of gas and so on. So how can European leaders be motivated to sign up for 25 years of gas, which is what Russia wants? But if they don't, Russia's not going to drill and they need the gas now. So like, I don't understand where all this is going to end. It speaks to a lot of volatility.
Essentially, Europe is saying that the gas market has now changed over to where it's like oil. You got to take the risk and you got to basically do your homework to figure out what it is that you're going to consume. But at the same time, remember that the message coming from Europe is that demand is dropping because it's all about our Fit for 55.
But it's not, really. This is the big deception, or I don't know what you call it. Like, everybody thinks demand's going down, and it's not.
To me, it's like that driver that you've always seen where they stop at the stop sign, and a car is going through the intersection, and their mind has already said, oh, that car's through the intersection already, and they pull out and plow right in the middle of that car. Because in their mind, it was already through the intersection. So I get a little bit of a feeling it's like that with a lot of the European decision makers. Oh, we've already decided to move on to renewables and all this kind of stuff, and you ain't there yet, so to speak. So therefore, you've got to basically attend your knitting and do a little bit more and think a little bit more about the process of getting from point A to point B rather than thinking that in your mind, you've already written these white papers that talk about how you're already at point B and you're not there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Basically, it's a disorderly transition, basically, is what's going on, or a dysfunctional transition where we think we've moved to point B and we haven't. So, as I said just a couple minutes ago, though, that pressure from the Russians is to get those 25-year contracts. But the pressure from COP26 is going to be like, you can't sign up for any more fossil fuels. So how is this going to be resolved?
Again, Russia can talk about that, but I don't think that given the way that Europe has structured things, that there are going to be any long-term contracts.
So that means that Russia won't drill anymore. They say, well, fine, I won't drill.
No, Russia will basically look at what are our expectations for what we can sell in Europe. What do we really think the market is going to do in a very realistic sense? What is our market that we're looking at? But at the same time, you've also got another dynamic that's developing, which is long-term contracts on the other side of the globe. China is basically giving the same story, but China's in this situation where they do sign long-term contracts. And therefore, Russia can go ahead and create big new pipelines, and they can also go ahead and basically develop the upstream supply that goes along with that, because you have a much more assured offtake. So for Europe, it's kind of a little different dynamic. Mm-hmm.
So Matt, there's two ways that the EU policymakers could end this. One is they could say, we want to just speed up the energy transition, so we're not reliant on Russia. And I'd say that's what Brussels is proposing today. They just recently came out with how they're going to deal with this energy crisis. However, it's probably going to result in very high prices and maybe some backlash from consumers in Europe. Do you think that that's going to be a problem for them to stick on their clean energy path here?
Yes, I do. But please remember, I'm not a European analyst at all. Mm-hmm. But basically, I think that that's going to be the case. As you try to move too fast in situations where clearly your supply and reliability are not up to par, you're going to create a lot of political and social backlash with much higher prices. And of course, the story has been throughout that there really is no green premium. Renewables can be just as cheap as fossil fuels and all that kind of stuff. But the problem is, not really. There's always a green premium because you have the intermittent supply, you've got the whole connection of hookups and the transferability of this stuff. And so the result is you need to basically also think about the speed of the transition and kind of what is a little bit more reasonable and perhaps a little bit more acceptable. I don't know what you guys have seen in terms of a lot of the discussion, but you know, when I read a lot of these articles about climate change and the energy transition, there's sort of this narrative that basically it's big oil's fault. Big oil has lied to us all this time. If we can just simply stop big oil from lying about this, the energy transition is going to go ahead and we can all be just happy as can be and get along together. And of course, that's really not the case. The consumers of all of that energy stuff is us. We like to have our clothes washed. We like to eat beef. We like to have air conditioning in our houses, and we're not prepared to give that stuff up yet. Mm-hmm. And don't really see the need to.
Let's get back to Russia. We talked quite a bit about gas, but I want to move over to the oil side. Russia is part of that OPEC plus cartel. Let's sort of do the same thing. I sort of want to parse out what's going on between our images of Vladimir Putin being like some sort of James Bond villain and sort of manipulating markets and that kind of thing, whether it's on the oil or the gas side. I mean, do they really have the ability to grow their production?
Early on in this, we wrote a report called How Much Flexibility Do You Have, Comrade? And we basically said Russia has that kind of flexibility. And we also said they're going to go down and they're going to come back up. But basically, they're going to work within the OPEC Plus arrangement. And that's basically what they've done. So at the moment, they are still about 700,000 barrels a day lower than what they were at peak production in terms of total. But it is coming back, like I said, basically in line with the oil thing. They don't want to flood the market, but at the same time, there is a major worry about the supply response. The narrative now is that basically the market could easily shift off into a view of a shortage and drive prices to, pick your number, $100 a barrel or something like that. And again, our view is that Russia has the ability to move production up. It has been doing that ever since the supply restrictions came off. It's been adding about 100,000 barrels a day.
Yeah.
So it's coming back. Russia is very clearly a key part of OPEC+. Its decision-making authority, deal-making pressure, you know, leverage, whatever you want to call it, is on par with Saudi.
Yeah.
And the Saudis wanted this, and they basically got the Russians where they want them, front and center in terms of global oil market management.
So, Matt, I want to ask you, if we think a bit longer term, you know, in the West, we're seeing constraints on investment because investors don't want companies to grow. We're all moving on to other things, although we still use a lot of oil. Do you think Russia is in the position to really grow their production? I'm thinking over the next 5-10 years, as demand may still grow, and there'll be a lack of investment other places. Or are they also concerned about making investments because of energy transition?
Well, they're concerned about making investments because of the energy transition because they're worried about demand overall and how much it's going to be. But the overall picture for Russia is clearly one where they have, let's call them advantage barrels. These are barrels that can be produced at fairly low cost and with, you know, a fairly decent carbon footprint. And so therefore, Russia has this view, well, we have advantage barrels, therefore we can continue to invest. Our production can, in fact, grow, and we'll just simply take a larger market share as this space is evacuated by other companies. So they're thinking of themselves in the same category as being like the Middle Eastern producers.
Hey, Matt, before we let you go, you mentioned carbon footprints. Have Russian oil and gas companies and Putin himself bought into ESG and that whole movement?
Yes. Of course, the companies that have an international presence, Gazprom, Rosneft, Gazpromneft, Lukoil, all of these guys all have to do their ESG reports and sustainability reports, you know, whatever you want to call them. And so they put information out on their carbon emissions and what they've been doing to reduce it and all that kind of stuff. It's just part and parcel of what you have to do internationally, because all of these guys have a certain section of their shares that basically trade. At the same time, the boss has also become very concerned about this with things like the carbon border adjustment mechanism in Europe and what it means for the future and everything. So the result is that this week on Wednesday, they announced that their target is to go to carbon neutrality in 2060, like China.
As a country or the producers?
As a country. And at the same time, over the past few months, we've also seen a number of things where they're creating mechanisms to measure this stuff, the emissions. They haven't established a trading mechanism yet, but clearly they're getting ready for that as they think about how to protect their exports from the European cross-border carbon adjustment mechanism. So it's moving. They realize that it's real. It will have real impacts upon them. But on the other hand, at the moment, it's not an existential crisis in terms of their long-term energy future. It looks to us like there is going to be a significant role for oil and gas in the global energy balance out through 2050 at least. And Russia can basically play a role in that. It's just simply going to be cleaner, and a lot of the overall incremental supply is going to be renewables and other sort of things like that.
This has been such a fascinating conversation. We really appreciate it. Matt, you convinced me. I thought we were going to talk about the villain, Vladimir Putin. Not the James Bond, the good one, but the villain one.
One of the questions that everybody asks me, they go, what are Putin's overarching foreign policy objectives for energy? How is it that he's using this as a weapon? And I just sort of laugh and I just go, what he's looking for is he's looking for reliable markets for his energy exports. That's what this is all about. You can sort of see this. So they're looking for sensible, reliable markets. If the Chinese provide that, great. If Europe does that, great. But they would really like to basically kind of depoliticize this as much as possible. It's just that for us, because they're doing other things that we don't like, whether it's Crimea or poisoning people's underpants and all this kind of stuff, because it looms so big in their economy, that's where we tend to push the buttons.
Thanks for giving us your objective perspective. And I mean, we like to also think they're spewing methane into the atmosphere and killing the environment. So it's interesting.
We've heard that too. People have this idea that Gazprom is, you know, like the number one methane emitter in the world. And again, their own figures basically say it ain't so. And again, it's not so surprising. Yes, they produce a lot of gas, but they have very, very few wells. So they have lots fewer connections. Their pipelines are big, new, efficient, and don't really leak a lot, which is, again, everybody's using the same comparables with North America. And so when you look at their carbon footprint, and they don't frack, and they don't process. It's basically a very nice methane that comes out of the ground for them. It's a very sweet upstream operation. So the result is that they're actually, you know, on a per BCM basis, their carbon footprint is actually pretty low overall. But again, this is not the narrative that you hear, right?
Definitely. Well, thank you for sharing your perspectives. We really appreciate you being on the show. And,
all right.
And thanks to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.